From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with The Listen, the podcast that encourages community, cross-cultural dialogue, and open conversation. We're thrilled to bring you the third and final conversation in our Season 11 series focusing on the opioid crisis. In today's interview, we'll be talking about the importance of support, not only for opioid addicts, but for their loved ones, especially when the addict in question is a parent. My guest today is Emily Powers. Currently a freshman at Hanover College, she plans to double major in biology and sociology, possibly adding a minor in philosophy. While she is still unclear about what the future holds, she has no doubt that she wants to work with people. Some of her favorite pastimes include journaling, personal fitness, and reading. Welcome, Emily. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Kate. Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, I want to acknowledge that your story may be difficult to tell. I'm sure there are aspects that you would prefer not to share, and that's absolutely fine. But where would you like to begin? Let's start with a story you would like to tell.
I think I would like to begin my segment with informing you and some of your listeners on some facts related to drug addiction and drug recovery.
Okay.
So according to the American Addiction Centers, in 2017, approximately 4% of American teens from the age 12 to 17 suffered from a substance abuse disorder, or 1 in 25 kids. In the same year, 14.8% of the population aged 18 to 25 battled, or 1 in 7 people, along with 6.4% of adults aged 26 and older. Of the 2.3 million people in American prisons and jails, more than 65% meet the criteria for addiction, and 75% of these individuals who suffer from a mental illness also struggle with addiction. In 2017, an estimated 20.7 million people aged 12 and older needed treatment for a substance use disorder. Only 4 million people, or 19%, received that needed treatment. Mm. But lastly, I would like everyone to know that addiction is considered a highly treatable disease and recovery is attainable.
Wow, that is some really great context for us to start with. And I think, you know, really important because a lot of people don't have those facts. And it's the facts that will give us what we need, right? Those are the tools we need to actually move ahead. So thank you for that. Why don't you take us back? I think you're 18 now. Is that right, Emily?
I am just turned 19 in August.
So. Okay, well, happy birthday. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Why don't you take us back to some memories that occurred before your mom's struggle with drug addiction began? What do you remember about the years before her addiction became a focal point in your family?
So honestly, there are only a handful of memories that I can remember because as far as to my knowledge goes, my mom's relapse into her drug addiction began right after my little sister was born, and she was actually prescribed prescription opioids by her doctor, even though he was told by my dad and few loved ones that it wouldn't be good for her knowing. But before her relapse into her pill addiction happened, I remember just like little things that would make me happy. So there's this one memory, and it's kind of goofy, but I would remember us going before she would go to work, because I would go to work with her some days, and we would go and stop at McDonald's, and I'd get me my cute little breakfast. And as I've like grown older, I've always thought back to that memory whenever I wake up too late and I don't make it to McDonald's for like the breakfast time, because it ends at like 10 a.m. I'm like, how did I make it there when I was a kid, but not now? Or just little things like us going and visiting our grandparents together, or some like little like birthday parties that I had. But most of the good memories have come after her recovery began.
Interesting. And when was that?
And they've been abundant.
How old were you when her recovery began?
So my mom actually turned herself in to our local jail when I was in fifth grade. So I think I would have been 11, maybe 12, okay, because I've always been like a little older for my grade. But, and then she was incarcerated for a little bit over 2 years. And so in my eighth grade year is when she got out and she came home and was back with us. And it was just a total 360 degree turnaround.
Mm.
But we had been, it's not like we had lost contact. I mean, we were going and visiting her every single week. We were there every Sunday, no doubt, unless something was going on. And I mean, visitation hours were not, you know, conveniently early in the day. It's like 8 p.m. at night, and then you just had to wait so long. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't understand when you're that age and you're so embarrassed by your experience or, like, feeling ashamed, like there's something you could have done or your parents' actions are reflecting on who you are as a person, especially in like that social atmosphere when you're in school and you're around all these other peers that are not living the same life you are. You just feel like you're alone. And so going and visiting her every week and seeing how many people struggled from the same, from having a loved one taken away from them, it was just like kind of enlightening to me.
Yeah. Did it help you to see that your family wasn't the only family that was going through this?
I think it did help me. I remember my little sister actually learned how to knit from a woman that was there visiting one of her loved ones at the same time every week. And so there were like little things that you looked forward to as a kid, or like even in the midst of like all the hard times and all the like negativity and everything that seems like your life is just like turned upside down. Mm-hmm. There were just little things that we looked forward to. We looked forward to seeing our mom. We looked forward to seeing the lady that taught her how to knit, or going out to eat afterwards because it was too late. And so our dad didn't want to make anything. And so
I can imagine that. I can imagine that.
Yeah.
I heard you say so clearly, Emily, that there are many, abundant is the word you used, abundant mm-hmm. positive memories and experiences after your mom's recovery began. Do you mind if we go back a little bit and talk about so you also talked about when you were really little and you have, you know, your McDonald's mm-hmm. memory and your birthday party memories. What did it look like when things began to change? Were you aware that your mom was struggling, or as a child, were you somehow shielded from that?
I think I have always been a really intuitive kid. I've always been really perceptive to things that I feel other people my age wouldn't have been. And so I did begin to notice when things were changing. Even just little things that didn't seem like they were so like went together in my mind. But, you know, as a kid, you're just like, oh, well, I just don't know better. There were definitely times where she was more irritable. She was angry. She would be mad for no reason, like more short with us, probably with me in particular, because I was definitely that child who was more intuitive and was asking questions all the time. She wasn't really eating that often, as people who are struggling with addiction tend to not really have an appetite or only have an appetite for like sweet things or candy. She would be coming home late from work, or even when I would be writing with her, I mean, she would probably cash maybe 3 or 4 checks in a week. And I'd be like, oh, well, how did you get another check? And she'd be like, oh, I saved my one from last week. And, you know, as a kid, you're like, oh, okay.
Right.
And so just like little things like that. But I think the biggest thing for me, the biggest like factor, was when you are in fifth grade, you're put through a program called DARE. And it is about drug resistance and like staying away from drugs and doing what's best for you. And I remember we all got a little booklet and you go through and you learn about it. They have teachers come in, mostly like cops or like, people who work at like addiction centers or in the jails, and they come in and they teach you and try to terrify you a little and mostly just try to keep you safe. But I remember coming home one day, and this was maybe a month before my mom ended up turning herself in. And keep in mind, as like a 11, 12 year old kid, you are terrified to come up and accuse your mom of anything. And so I came up with her with my little book, and I was like, remember asking her, "Mom, are you doing pain pills?" And like, just because I was hearing it amongst family, people in my family, like talking about it at social events or just seeing signs on my own time or learning about it in DARE and making connections. And I will never forget, but just like her face, she just started bawling her eyes out and like hugged me and cried. And she was like, "I would never do that to you. I would never do that to you." And then a month later, I remember coming home from school one day and my dad just being like, "Well, your mom is taking some time off work. Like, she's not going to be going to work for a while." And just everything going, you know, like downhill, but uphill from there, because you have to hit, you know, rock bottom in order to make your way up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know so many other people personally that still are struggling and don't have family members that care about them enough to guide them mm-hmm. to rock bottom and force them to go get the help they need.
It sounds like, I mean, the picture that you're painting, it sounds like your mom was so lucky and you were so lucky that all of this was happening in the context of a family. I mean, it sounds like you guys never stopped being a family. And, you know, of course, there was a period in there, and we'll get into this more as we move on in our conversation. There was a period when, she wasn't able to be present as your mom, but she never stopped being your mom, and you were able to see her, you know, every week during those visitation hours. And I can't imagine what it would be like to go through an experience like this alone, you know, without people telling mm-hmm. you can do it. I'm here for you. Do you want to talk about it? That kind of thing. Would you agree?
I would. I think it would have been a totally different experience if she didn't have, me or my little sister, but even just my dad, like, he did not have to stay. He had no obligation to stay or to take care of us. He didn't have an obligation to stay with her, but it would not have turned out the same without him. He was the backbone of our family for a while, and he just, like, there is not a lot of people who would stay through what he stayed through. Mm-hmm. And I know my mom knows how lucky she is, or I hope she knows how lucky she is, but it's crazy.
I'll bet she does. Mm-hmm. Emily, we are going to need to pause for a moment, but we'll be right back to hear more from Emily Powers. Back in a second. Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit rafsanpedro.es. That's RAFFSANPEDRO.ES. This is Kate Jetmore with The Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is Emily Powers, here to share her experience growing up with a mother who was battling an opioid addiction. Could you share some of your coping strategies, Emily? What things did you start doing or stop doing as your mom's addiction got worse?
I think losing my mom for a period of my time made me want to step up and be a strong figure, a strong individual figure for myself. And in sixth grade, I actually joined the men's wrestling team at our high school. I remember coming home one day and telling my dad, being like, "Oh, hey, Dad, I'm going to join." And he like laughed and was like, "Ha ha, let's see how long that lasts." So of course, you know, me being like the strong-headed person I am, I was like, "Well, now I have to do it because he said I wouldn't." And at the time, I didn't think that I wouldn't have put two and two together and even drawn the connection that was me trying to step up and gain some strength and confidence in myself and trying to assert my own, just like my own will to power, like my own being there for myself. But being a part of the wrestling team and learning that I'm strong not only physically but mentally, I think building that family around me, having these people that I could turn to, it really did, it helped me cope a lot. And even though I quit wrestling my freshman year, I have continued to weight train my entire life, which is one of the biggest stress reliefs that I have ever had. There's nothing like being able to go in there and better yourself, knowing that you're doing it purely out of your own self-love, like you wanting to go in there and strengthen yourself and better yourself every day, doing something little that you can control, that you can change, really did help me. Other than that, I didn't have a lot of time for, I don't know, reading or hanging out with my friends. I had to kind of take on that second role of mom sister for my little sister. I had to give up a lot of my summers, stay home with her. I had to, I got to, you know, watch her and be there for her. And I will never forget forcing her to watch every single episode of Avatar The Last Airbender every single summer. So just kind of forcing her to hang out with me just really did help. I've also always loved to read and draw and write, and you can see in my drawings, even in my poetry, a lot of the change between when I was having a lot of struggles mentally going through with my mom. You could see this like sadness and anger and kind of confusion portrayed through my art or through my poetry compared to even what you see later on in my high school years or even now.
Did you have access to any like therapy during that time, Emily? Or were you mainly just coping on your own in the way that you've described?
I was not going to therapy at that time, but I started going to therapy when my mom came back home. However, during that time, I think teachers do not get enough credit because I did have a few teachers that paired as my therapist. I mean, my guidance counselors were there for me and they were also a big support for me, but I think some students, most students throughout their lifetime just form a certain connection to a teacher, like a mentor, a coach, some sort of adult figure in your school, which is really strange. Like even in my sociology class, we talk about how big agents of socialization, like teachers and administrators and school workers are. Like they are there for you and they help develop you throughout your life. And I really did rely on teachers during this time. In specific, my Spanish teacher, her name, well, Senora Hall, but her name is Rachel Hall, and she was just amazing. She was always there for me. I could go in, she would know when I was having a bad day, when something was off. She knew what to say. She knew how to talk to me, how to make me believe that there was like good coming, that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that I can do whatever I want with my life and I can shape it however I see fit.
That is amazing. I mean,
yeah.
Did she know what was going on? Were you sharing her the details of your story and your mom's story?
She did know what was going on. I don't think at that time I was really too detail-oriented about it. I mean, I probably wasn't telling them every single part of how I felt or every single thing that happened, but she did know. She knew what was happening and what was going on with my mom and what I was going through, and teachers see a lot more than you think anyway. And so even when I didn't know what was going on with me, she would know some days. So she was definitely a really big help for me.
It sounds like the adult figures in your life during that time who were most present and most supportive were teachers. Is that what you're saying?
I would say that, I would think. My grandparents were always there for me and they have always been there for me. However, they live in a different state. And, you know, they and my dad was definitely, he was my biggest you know, just he was my rock throughout this entire time. My dad is there, but, you know, he's working all the time. And I'm at school, you know, most of the time. Like, that is where your life is shaped. That is who you are. That is where you make yourself, which it can be sad for some people because, you know, who really loves high school? But
did any of the experience that you're describing with, you know, having teachers who are really stepping up and just being so available to you, has that affected you? Has that made you want to be a teacher or be that kind of figure for a young person?
Strangely, I have never had a desire to be a teacher, although I have had many people tell me I would be perfect at being an elementary school teacher or even like a guidance counselor being there for people. I do know that I do want to be there for people. Sociology is one of the most interesting aspects of my college experience so far, and I've really debated going in and talking to those who are in prisons, being like they're a counselor for them, a sort of therapist or psychiatrist for them who have been through really, really rough times, who have really bad mental diseases, maybe those with dissociative identity disorder or schizophrenia who we don't know that much about, or even people who have struggled with narcotics and opioid addictions. But I don't think being a teacher for me, I don't know. You have to have a sort of passion to be a teacher mm-hmm. that I don't have. Mm-hmm. Even though teachers are probably some of the most influential people in my life, I don't think I would do their job mm-hmm. as well as they have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you before I even met you, and today's the first time I'm meeting you, I wanted to ask you about school, and you've already sort of answered this question saying, you know, school really provided an really important and significant structure for me. My teachers were important to me. That's not the case for everyone. I mean, some people, they, you know, just school isn't for them. They're not strong students. Mm-hmm. And then if they get into, you know, if their family gets into a crisis like this, I can imagine that their reaction is just to, you know, hide and even do worse in school than they were doing before. It sounds like that's not your case, that you kind of sought solace in school and maybe became an even better student. Would you say that that describes your experience?
I think I would. Honestly, from my perspective, I think a lot of kids in my school already had a lot going for them. They had parents who were quote unquote normal, who had middle to upper class lives, great jobs. They were really involved in the community, really involved in their schoolwork, you know, the PTO moms or the parents who were just involved in the community. You know, they all went out to eat together. They all went out to the sports games together. So all these kids had these statuses that already kind of put them a level up in the game. And so for me, I realized that I didn't have, you know, parents that everybody knew. I wasn't a big name in the community. Teachers didn't know me because my parents were teachers. I wasn't having the newest clothes or the hottest trends. I didn't have the newest iPhone. So naturally, I think I realized that in order for me to be seen as a success, in order for me to be seen in a higher status, I needed to demonstrate that I was smart, that I was the smartest, I was one of the smartest, that I can work the hardest, that I wanted to be the best at something, even if I wasn't the prettiest or the, you know, the most wealthy, or I didn't have the coolest parents or with the best jobs. I wanted to prove my worth in some way. And I think school was probably the healthiest way that I could have chosen to do that.
Yeah.
I am really grateful. I don't know exactly what pushed me to want to do good in school. I mean, growing up, I always wanted to do good. Like in elementary school, I was always, you know, conscious of like how I was doing. I was, if I wasn't, if I wasn't getting as much praise as the other kids in class, I maybe felt down on myself. It's just ingrained in you as you grow older that you are defined by your grades and by how you act in school, which I think that is separate. I think grades and intelligence can be total opposite thing, that your intelligence does not always have to be determined by grades. Mm-hmm. But for me personally, it was just something I could use to say, I am worthy. Like, I am here. I am, I'm smart. Like, I can give myself that thing. Like, hey, here I am. I'm the smart kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so schoolwork, grades, it was a really nice distraction for me. It was something that I spent a lot of time in, put a lot of my effort into, and it's really paid off. Like, going to college, being at the oldest private school in Indiana and not really having to pay anything for tuition to go here. I mean, getting scholarships. I'm like, not many children of parents who suffer from opioid addiction can say that they got a nomination to the West Point, the military academy. Like, not many people can say that. And I know my mom is proud of me, and I know that my story wouldn't be the same without her, without everything that happened.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it's quite a story. It really is. Let's take another short break, and we'll be right back to continue our conversation with Emily Powers. It is such a pleasure to share our interviews with you each week, and your feedback means the world to us. If you subscribe to our podcast and rate and review your favorite episodes, it helps widen our audience and bring more people into the fold. I'm also hoping you'll visit our website at thelistenpodcast.com, where you can let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. You can find us on social media and check out the Listen blog, also available on our website. Once again, that's thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking today with Emily Powers about what it was like growing up while her mother battled an opioid addiction. Emily, are there any organizations or support groups that you'd like to recommend that you've found helpful over the years?
I think what I would recommend to children of parents who suffer from addictions or struggles with opioid abuse is to really look for solace in your teachers and your administrators at your school. Like, they are there for you. They're there because they want to be there and they want to help you. And even if you are that kid who is always angry and grumpy and you don't know how to convey your emotions, or you never want to do your schoolwork, or you're always late on class, they're not going to turn you away. If you go up to them and you tell them how you're feeling and if you need a support system, they will be there for you. I have also found a big support, just like a super big support net of people on social media. And I want you to be safe with this. I like, don't go friend or like start talking to all these random strangers, but even not certain actual people, but certain pages that have stories of others like me, stories of others like my mom, where you can read it and you could really see it from their perspective and see how they handled it, I think really helped me cope and helped me realize that her intention was not to hurt us. Her intention was not to do anything bad. You just have to, I would say, educate yourself. Just go out there and educate yourself on it. Lean into those around you at your school, at your work, at your college. Your family is like the biggest support system that you can have. Really lean into your family. Books, I would say, are a really big comfort and really big solace for me. Just knowing that you have people and resources around you to help you better understand.
Have you read any specific books on this subject, Emily, or are you just saying read for pleasure?
I haven't read anything like nonfiction on this subject, but I have read books and watched documentaries on people that have suffered with addiction, on, you know, anyone from people who are born into a bad life and are struggling with it from the age of, you know, 12 all the way up throughout their life, not being able to make their way out of the situation, or even like child prodigies who ended up going towards addiction and using it as a coping mechanism. So I think it's really interesting to realize that you're not alone, and to just read up on material, watch shows, you know, just watch movies about it, watch documentaries, just getting that feeling of like community, of you not being alone.
That's great advice. That's great advice. You know, when people talk about the quote unquote opioid crisis, it's often a very abstract issue. I mean, people don't have a personal experience. It's something that they've heard about, or they've seen sort of randomly on the internet or in a magazine article. But for you, it is quite personal. What do you wish people knew that could help to increase their compassion and understanding on this subject?
I wish people knew that it was more common than what we thought. I think a lot of people like to have judgment as their first and foremost thought when it comes towards the opioid crisis. I think being in college and having this higher education about it has really enlightened me on the subject. I wish people knew that a great number of Americans suffer from opioid addiction, and that it could happen to anyone, that it could be you, it could be your kids, it could be your parent. I mean, you never know when it's going to happen, what it's going to happen. You never know if you have to get a major surgery one day and you end up having to rely on these prescription opioids, which is something that has happened often. Like, doctors accidentally starting an addiction. And I just wish that people knew how to approach it and how to really offer help and not just label people as, you know, addicts, just addicts for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. And you are more than one status. Like, we are all made up of all these multifaceted traits and personalities of ourselves, and that you can't just call off a person who struggles with the disease.
Is this an awareness that you've come to, not only because you've walked with your mom as she's had this journey, but also because you've known other people who've struggled with addiction?
I definitely think it is. I have known quite a few people that have struggled, and I know that if people would quit turning a blind eye and would take the initiative in them to confront them and to tell them that they need help and to show them these resources that are in front of them, to be there holding their hand through it, I think it would not be as much of a crisis as people just brushing it off, saying it happens, that it's just a common thing. I also think I would advise people to let go of like the anger in their hearts that they hold. I know that was probably one of the biggest things for me, was it was easy for me to just be mad at my mom. It was easy for me to just rule it off as, you know, well, all the inconveniences in my life happened because of this, because of A, B, and C, because she did this, blah, 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 blah. And so I just held all this anger. But when you start to realize that you have free will, you have a role in this, you can take what happened to you and you can grow from it, or you can be bitter about it. You can make it influence you to be more compassionate, or it can make you more closed-minded. It can make you, I don't know. I just want people to have more compassion in their heart for it.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like what you're saying is that's a choice. You know, you can move toward a position of compassion of your own free will. Even if you do feel angry or resentful, you can move toward a position of compassion. Mm-hmm. I know you're in college now. You mentioned that you had some really incredible choices when it came time to decide where you were going to study. You opted for Hanover College in Indiana, which is a really incredible school. Tell us what you're studying and what we can hope to see from you in the future.
So right now, my hope is to double major in biology and sociology. And for the future, I have no idea what it will precisely hold, but I know it will be a roller coaster ride. I'm already planning so many talks and lunches with alumni to discuss their careers and their majors that they've created. I am in so many amazing classes that have taught me so much and just opened up the interest for me so much more. There's this one class, and it is like confronting crime and poverty in Indiana, and it is just totally about the like opioid crisis and confronting it here. And there's a class about, you know, the philosophy of existentialism that I'm in, or my biology class about animal behavior, and all of these things just super interest me. And Hanover has done nothing but made me realize that there are so many opportunities in the world. But I do know that what people can expect is that I will be working with people and I will be making a big impact on their life, whether that is counseling them, helping them, interviewing them, guiding them towards their future. I know that that is what I want to do.
That's wonderful, Emily. My heart is so full hearing you talk about, you know, what you're doing now and where it's going to lead you in the future. I am so excited for you. And I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today, for adding your voice to the conversation. It's such an important part of the puzzle. And I know that our listeners will really benefit from what you have to say and from your perspective. So thank you so much. And I wish you and your family all the best.
Thank you so much.
This concludes our season 11 series on the opioid crisis. Many thanks to David Jetmore, Nicole Powers, and Emily Powers. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, where the impressive Antonio Pérez Art Foundation is located in a 17th century Carmelite convent. If you enjoyed this interview, I encourage you to check out our full archive by becoming a subscriber or by visiting our website at thelistenpodcast.com. There are dozens of interviews waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. I want to thank our producer, Lauren Lovett, and EJ Jetmore, who handles our social media. And many thanks to Lucas Munoz Jetmore for editing the show, providing tech support, and writing our theme music. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is The Listen.